Good morning, everyone. So this morning, instead of our normal discourse, Rebecca Lee and I are going to do a mando together. Rebecca has been here this long weekend offering a retreat, and she's in Master Sheng Yan's lineage, has been here a number of times, and we've been very honored and happy to have you here, and appreciate your, you've worked very hard over the last couple of days, and so appreciate your doing a little bit more before you leave for home. We were talking about this morning in the Mondo, and this morning we did a memorial for those, all of those millions of people who have died from COVID. And of course, there are many, many more who were affected in very, very difficult ways by that pandemic, this pandemic. And there are those who are still in the midst of it. We are also in the midst of a war that is happening in Europe that is affecting the whole world. And the basis of which is terrible, and the ramifications of which will likely also be very, very painful, not just for those in Ukraine and the Russians, but for all of us, really. The world has always been small, and it's getting smaller. We're also seeing the rise of authoritarianism around the world, the threatening and loss of civil rights in our own country, concerted efforts to exclude people from the basic right to vote, the ongoing wealth inequality, attacks on women and black and brown bodies, LGBTQIA people. And all of this is, of course, taking place within the, not just the background, but the permeating presence of climate change, which we really should be putting our greatest attention on. But all of these other human-caused afflictions keep demanding our attention. And so within this landscape, which is impermanent and changing, but may very likely be changing for more of this, how do we hold that? And in particular, how do we hold grief, sorrow, sadness, heartbreak, a heaviness of heart? How do we hold the heaviness that many of us feel, even when we're not actively thinking about or aware of, or coming into contact with the stories or the images, the voices of those who are suffering? But even in other moments, simple moments, if we're awake and aware, we may feel a heaviness within us, even in moments of joy. And a cousin of grief, despair. And to think of it as a sort of moving that grief into a sense of hopelessness, anguish, being disheartened, sort of losing our hearts, faith in ourselves, in humanity, in civil societies. There's something wrong with that. It's talking to me too much. can lead to discouragement, pessimism. Joanna Macy, in speaking about grief and despair in relationship to climate change, described it as a loss of a cherished or essential assumption that our species, our humanity, will actually pull through, right? The specter that that may not actually be true, or may not be true in the way that we would most hope. That, and to expand that, that beyond climate change, or, yeah, to that people are and will be fair-minded, caring, compassionate, ultimately, essentially, that we will continue to be lovers of peace, desiring the ability to be self-governing, that we will continue to be those people, that we will be protectors of free and true speech. And so we can think of all the many ways in which we see currents, movements in our world that for such people can be quite distressing. She says, in our culture, the acknowledgement of despair can be a kind of social taboo. You know, of course, there are many, many cultures within any country. But if we just think about sort of social norms, that to acknowledge despair, she's saying, can be a breaking of a taboo. And to feel that then within such an environment can create a sense of isolation, right? That you are alone in that because it's not something that we acknowledge together. And so she says that's that despair, both individually but then on a social level, because we are always living within a social world, ultimately derives from the fact that we are so deeply interconnected. Avalokiteshvara realizes mind, all beings have one essence. And so our capacity to grieve for others, she says, and our power to meet that grief, both spring from this great, what she calls the great matrix of our relationships in which we take our being, in which our being arises. So she's recognizing and identifying that grief and despair, which we might see as very sort of negative, burdensome qualities, as actually deriving from the deepest part of our humanity, of our self-nature, a kind of message, a signal. She says, we are as open systems sustained by flows of energy and information that extend beyond the reach of our conscious self. And I thought of the Buddhist understanding of prana or winds or energy, ki, samadhi, and the role of that that we are cultivating and developing within our practice, and how within our grief, when it's not practiced well, within our attachments, that wind, that essential energy, gets so bound and tangled. You know, as biological creatures, as Evelyn Underhill in her book on mysticism says, you know, we need food, we need water, we need shelter, we need warmth. That's what we need to survive as a biological creature. But as human beings, we need relationships with people, with the earth and all of its creatures, with mountains and rivers, with cities, with beauty, with art, with music, with dance, with laughter, with purpose. And so to look at the ways in which that grief or despair arise out of a sense of loss or a breach with those essential sacred bonds that we have with ourselves and each other and all things, so that we can be fully human. She says the first step is to disabuse ourselves from the notion that the grief for a world is morbid or wrong or a negative thing. She says to experience anguish and anxiety in the face of perils that threaten us is a healthy reaction. It's both a survival reaction, but it's also coming out of that sense that something essential is under threat. And it gets our attention. She said, this pain is a testimony to the unity of all life, the deep interconnections that relate us to each other and all beings. If it was just about our own survival, then we wouldn't experience so much of this because it would just be a matter of whether I am surviving or not. But to actually be a human being, that's not nearly enough. She says, such pain becomes self-afflicted suffering only when we assume personal guilt for its plight. We are responsible for why this is happening, or personal responsibility for its solution. I've taken a bodhisattva vow to alleviate the suffering. I should be able to stop this. I should be able to fix this. She said, that's when that sense of grief becomes self-inflicting. When we're actually moving further and further away from the Dharma. She says, no individual is that powerful. So to let go of the manipulative assumption that the conscious self can or should be in control of all events is, in a sense, one of our deepest delusions. Each of us is but one little nexus in a vast web. As the recognition of our interdependence breaches our sense of isolation, heals our sense of isolation, so does it also free our despair of self-loathing, self-criticism, not being sufficient, not doing enough. And so within our bodhisattva vows and our ongoing cultivation of opening our hearts, allowing ourselves to actually experience the suffering in very intimate ways, and then opening that up to all beings, to the whole world, how do we hold all of this within ourselves, right? So that we can actually fulfill our vows. We can be that bodhisattva practitioner. And how do we work with these strong emotions that we feel that are natural reactions, but can be very debilitating, very suffering-making? Would you like to?
You're so perfect. I don't know if I need to say anything. I'm a huge fan of Joanna Macy's work, and thank you, Roshi, for sharing that with us. And indeed, opening our heart to the world's suffering is the bodhisattva path. But maybe if we are not going about it skillfully, we can be causing unnecessary suffering and debilitating us from actually doing what we can. And I met a lot of people. I don't know if you had that, you shared this experience. They consume a lot of news reports as a way to learn about what's going on in the world. So things that are happening in the world, like climate change and war and other forms of difficulties. Also what's happening with the suffering and pandemic. Oftentimes, we learn about them through news reporting. Right? We're not in Ukraine. Right? We're not in some of these places with flooding. Some of us might have. My basement was flooded in September with that giant storm in New Jersey. I live in New Jersey. Right? Not very serious. But most of the time, we saw those images on news. And these news reports sort of like basically shape our sense of what's going on. And perhaps it is helpful for us to take some time to look at these input that shapes our impression of what's going on and make sure that we are having a view of this, and see if we're having a view of the world that is not distorted. I'm not denying that there are suffering, climate change issues, inequality. So that's been eloquently articulated. I would like to invite us to look at, what are we getting from the news? I don't know if you noticed that News does not report everything that happens. Did you notice that? Because it's not possible for news to report everything that happens. So there is picking and choosing. How do they pick and choose what to include in a news report, which shapes our view of what's going on in the world? News usually reports what is extraordinary, right? News does not report, hey, Rebecca Lee went to work today and she did her job and she helped some people and went home. Nobody would want to read that news. But that's the majority of what happens every day in the world. We don't read about that at all. In fact, almost 3 dozen people spend the last 2 days practicing sincerely in a retreat to cultivate wisdom and compassion. Are you going to read about it in the news? I doubt it, maybe except in your own newsletter. You're not going to read it in the New York Times. So what shows up in the news that we ultimately will read about? Extraordinary things. And usually, I don't know if you notice, do you read about good news, wonderful things people are doing, or terrible things that people are doing? All kinds of wonderful things are happening. We don't read about them in the news. We read about moments of conflict, violence, destruction, terrible behavior. We read about moments of people behaving badly on the airplane. And then we believe that's what's happening on the airplane all the time. I actually haven't seen it. I flew a fair amount this last couple of years. But we believe that flying is just really dangerous because there are these people, you know, hitting people. So we may not notice how this focus on violence and conflict and destruction and terrible behavior shapes our perception of the world. And oftentimes, that's just moments of what happened there. I don't know if you had experienced this, because I have. You go to a protest. It's largely kind of boring in most protests. You just walk there, not much happening. 99.999% of the protest, that's what we were doing, just walking. And then maybe there's like a couple seconds of some people, you know, maybe like kind of move too fast and someone fell over. Ka-chow! That's the pictures that the journalists wanted. And that's what shows up in the newspaper. That's what shows up in the evening news. And then you believe that's the protest. People pushing other people around. Completely different from what folks have experienced actually in the protest. So I didn't even see people falling. We were just walking, hanging out. But we are convinced, oh, I know that's what's happening in the protest. If we notice this, we realize that what we believe we know about the world is a fairly distorted view, because the news report focuses on a very narrow range of the happenings. And like I said, it does not report all the wonderful things people are doing. Yes, we have a very disturbing situation with our climate. But there are also a lot of people working very hard, coming up with solutions, actually putting in action those solutions. I meet them from time to time. What they do never shows in the news. We don't read about them. So what happens? We are left with the impression that everything is falling apart. We only have problems. No one's doing anything about it. Oh dear, oh dear. Despair Yeah, we acknowledge that despair, but it's, we might be only feeling despair when all these wonderful, hopeful things are also going on, also part of our reality. But we don't see that at all because of the distorted view from the news. Again, I'm not saying that all these troubles are happening. I read the news, I know. But while I'm reading the news, I also remind myself that's not all of what's happening. That's not a comprehensive view of our world. So as practitioner cultivating total clear awareness of each moment, I invite you to look into that and observe around ourselves. Very often when we bury our head into these news report too much during the day, then we neglect that all around us there are loving people, loving families, people flourishing in their lives, doing wonderful things. You are doing wonderful things. But we completely dismiss that when we only focus on that. And also, by allowing ourselves to be here in this moment, yes, I'm reading these news, and there are all this suffering and feel for it. And when we look up from the news, right here, right now, what do we see? Do we see all these wonderful living, breathing beings in front of us? And the birds still singing. That too is part of the present moment. And we allow this joy to arise in our heart so that we do not allow this despair to completely bury us and become debilitated and feel that it's completely hopeless. This, what's the point? Whatever I do won't really make a difference. Of course it will make a difference. Every moment is the coming together of causes and conditions. What you do and don't do will most definitely make a difference. And this practice opening our heart to allow joy, that is right here in the present moment. That's what I do. Like, I sit at the dining table across from my husband, and I read the news on my laptop, and then there are all these things happening. Now look up. Here is this wonderful person sitting right here, so happy, so blessed. There is all, and it's a less distorted view of reality. And that allows us to be available, to see the causes and conditions right here that allow us to engage in the action, maybe with our resources, with our ability to do something. So I leave it at that.
Okay. So this is where we'll open it up. I think the plan is, because we're going to have somebody with a mic, so we'll go from north side and then south side, and then we'll see if there are any questions from the folks who are joining us from their homes. Gokhan will read them. So if you'd like to say something or ask a question, just raise your hand and Laurel will bring you the mic. And on the south side is Brandt, okay? So this is where you get involved. Why don't we go ahead? We'll start on the south side.
I wanted to ask about grieving. I usually understand grief as a process that happens after there's been a loss, but now it seems like these losses are just ongoing. And we don't even know what the loss is yet. I'm thinking of climate change and COVID and this war and many other things. So I'm just wondering if you could say more about grieving in that kind of situation. It seems to me, I don't know, unlike, say, when someone I love dies, you know, the death has happened, you know, it's over in a sense. And then grief is some process to respond to what's happened. But we're just in the midst of things that keep happening. So I'm wondering how to hold grief in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about grief, you should answer.
So this is how dualities are born, right? I'm the grief guy. Everything is and can be seen as a process, right? Nothing is fixed. Everything is in motion. And so in the moment, what we call grief is just a word, right? For a living experience that, and as Joanna Macy was pointing to, that is a result of being in a intimate contact with our world and ourselves. And that's where, you know, these emotions, all that we experience, all the sensations, you know, why do we study them? Why do we turn our attention to them? Is it just to let them go because they're intrinsically binding? They're not. Nothing has intrinsic power to bind. And as practitioners, particularly in the Mahayana, on the Bodhisattva path, it's about seeing that everything has the same self-nature. And so why do we call one emotion joy or happiness and another emotion grief or sadness, right? They are different, but our experience of them is based in our karma, and how we respond to them is based in our karma. And so we're learning how to both experience it without all of those judgments and labels, and so that we can experience the living thing of it, right? The living experience before our mind fills it up with projections. Why? Because those projections are what bind us. When Rebecca said it makes us more available, that's to others, but it's also to ourselves. We are more available to ourselves. I mean, just think about when we're caught, entangled in a very strong emotion. It's very difficult to do much of anything. Simple things, right, become difficult. Everything becomes very close and closed. And so there is something going on. That's why we don't deny them or ignore them. You know, the Buddha said that's one way of continuing to create suffering, is by trying to have an aversion to trying to shut things down. And so we learn how to be very present to that discomfort, right, until it ceases to be uncomfortable, both in the actual experience, but also in our view of it, our opinion of it, our judgment of it. We begin to see it as something that actually has the potential to bring us in closer into contact with each other, into some helpful response.
I guess maybe what I add is you talk about we don't know what we have lost. Of course, can you hear me better? Okay, thank you. Thank you. I need to know whether you hear, you can hear me? Okay. So talking about what we have lost, and of course, like Roshi mentioned, it's like every moment, the coming together of causes and conditions. The idea that something's lost has to do with our with the belief that that older status quo is how it's supposed to be. Now some of that is gone, so lost. We feel it, and it has happened. So, for example, with our climate change, my husband and I are birders. So I read about how many hundreds of species of birds have disappeared because of climate change. So reading that, it's like there's this grief, just all these birds. Future generations don't get to see them, enjoy their beauty. I grieve for everyone who will miss that part of our beautiful world. But when we feel this, and then if we stick this label, grieve, there's just only grieve, and then we just push ourselves down, I feel terrible and I can't be happy and there's only grief, then we are closing ourselves instead of opening to see everything that's arising in the present moment. And in the midst of that grief, it's like, you hear the bird, like, these birds are still here. And now the gratitude can arise. There's still what we have. Some part is gone, some species are gone, some trees are gone, but we still have what we have here. So if we just focus on all the things that's lost, we fail to appreciate what's still here. And when we appreciate what's still here, gratitude is part of this moment. So it's not just grief. Gratitude, joy, so happy I'm here with this bird singing. And the same thing happened in our personal loss. I lost a friend recently to cancer. And grief. But it allows me to appreciate my other friends who are still alive, making sure that I make time. So the grief in it, also gratitude, love. And so remembering not to make something into some fixed thing in our practice, it's very important. Thank you for the question.
You know, it reminds me of a story I was reading about a fellow who was doing a solo transatlantic sailboat voyage, and he ran into this huge storm, and the ship was capsizing. And as he was going, it ended up being this very long, very difficult survival experience. And as he was, the whole thing was going over, he looked up, and the sky was so beautiful. And he felt that, he saw that in that moment, that there was still space, right? Which seems completely incongruous, like, no, that wouldn't happen, right? But it does. Jackie. And if, well, somebody over here is talking, if somebody over here raises your hand, then you'll be ready with the mic.
I was wondering if you could speak to the urgency that gets put forward sometimes when issues arise in the world. For example, I was part of environmental groups a few years ago volunteering, and there's this sense of like, we need to change now. We need to do something now, otherwise, you know, the world's going to fall apart. Mm-hmm. And not having many tools at that point, you know, I sort of just followed along with that, thinking that if I did that, you know, I will be helping the world. And after a year, I ended up burning out quite a lot. So just wondering if you have any words around that sort of sense that, yeah, you know, when we look at the news, when we look at the social media platforms, there's always this sense of like, you know, we need to be doing something now, which can really, excuse me, I feel like take us away from the moment.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Yeah, I think that is what Roshi was talking about earlier, the warning by Johanna Macy, right? Not to turn it into something about me. Well, we have to do something. Okay, I'm doing this, and I'm really doing this. And then we expect things to change. Like, this reminds me of this story. I had these nephews, my sister's children, and the two boys and the older one, I think he was maybe like 6, and his younger brother's 4. And he's like always complaining that his younger brother is so selfish, you know, he's just always so naughty, and then like self-absorbed. And I said to him, the older brother, I said, like, you know, you have to understand he's little, he's young, and he will learn. He will become less selfish. And he's like, okay, so tomorrow? We thought, of course not tomorrow. But we do think that. We have to do this. Okay, I'm doing this, I'm recycling, I'm gonna do this, and you know, tomorrow climate change will be gone. I read all these books about racism. Tomorrow, racism will be gone. Oh. The anti-lynching law finally passed after over 100 years. Generations of legislators bring it up over and over and over and over and over again. If the first person who brought it up and said, like, I'm going to bring this up and tomorrow it needs to pass. If not, no more. I'm not going to spend any more time on it. We won't have the anti-lynching bill today. Notice our habit of having this very short time span. If I do something because we come from this self-centered perspective, I am doing this. It better work, and I better see the result I want. Being very attached to the outcome and attached to the timeline of how this is supposed to come to fruition. Like I said, everything we do changes the world. You do something, you educate other people about climate change, more people become informed about it. Maybe they don't do everything you tell them they should do. Do you do everything people tell you you should do? We do what we can do. What we do what our causes and conditions allow us to do now. And when a lot of people do that, there's change. In fact, there's a lot of change. A lot of people in the younger generation see environmental degradation as the number one problem. That's a huge change for those of us who are older. It's like people didn't care about climate change just 20 years ago. That's why Al Gore had to go make that film. When he made that film, remember, those of us old enough to see Inconvenient Truth? Oh my goodness, it was new. Nowadays, old news. It has changed, it has effect. And things, there will be all kinds of legislations, things that will happen. Maybe not in our lifetime. But it's okay. We made the contribution. So when we engage in these actions and do what we can and not get attached to the outcome, not get attached to how it must end, at least, well, like it has to happen in my lifetime. That's why this feeling of, like, you know, urgency, things take time. Things take time. It takes time for people to change their habits. So I hope it helps a little bit.
This is a question from Rachel, maybe a bit of a follow-up, about how to discern what we can realistically do in our lives and in response to the catastrophes that we see.
How to discern what we can do?
What we can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's, you know, each of our, it's in a sense our opportunity, our responsibility, which, you know, if you think of right understanding, the first of the Eightfold Path, which has a very particular meaning in Buddhism, but that we have to understand certain things. We have to have a certain conceptual understanding of what's going on. You know, just having a big open heart and running out to alleviate suffering can cause a lot of suffering. Right? If we don't understand the situation. A person can be deeply enlightened and walk into a room of conflict and have no idea what's going on. Right? And so if you think of Avalokiteshvara and all of those hands with implements, you know, think of each of those hands possessing, you know, skills, knowledge, instruments, tools, the necessary stuff of what we need in our time to be able to move forward. And, you know, towards what? You know, as Joanna Macy said, you know, we're just a, you know, we're, she said it differently, but in a sense, we're very, you know, we're just insignificant beings. We're just little, you know, moments of energy that appear in this life. You know, if you think of the whole of history, but we're not without impact, right? We have influence. And so that's why we chant the evening gatha. Time swiftly passes by, right? We can forget that and think we're going to live forever. We have all the time in the world, or that something, some issue will wait for us. And so to have that urgency, and particularly within our spiritual practice, but also patience. And Wendell Berry said to have patience in the midst of a crisis is a terrible thing to ask, right? It's a very difficult thing to ask of someone. But what's the alternative? What's on the other side of patience? Impatience, which is aggression, right? Which is aversion, right? So it's like, even if our hearts are in the right place, we can want to fix something by dominating, right? By controlling. And then we just become part of the same system. And that's what's so difficult about the time we're in, is we have to really find different ways or enlightened old ways, shift old ways, so that we don't keep creating the same problem as we're trying to resolve it. And that's from a Buddhist perspective why what we're doing as practitioners and what people all over the world are doing in their own ways, in their own traditions, in their own faiths, anybody who thinks about what it means to be a human being. You know, they're not just going through their lives eating, drinking, sleeping, working, all of which are essential things, but they're thinking, I'm alive. What does it mean that I'm alive? What do I do with this life? What is my responsibility to you? What is my place in this world? Those are essentially spiritual questions. And so anybody who is actively sincerely engaged in that is part of trying to affect a positive change. As Rebecca said, everybody's changing the world, right? But how? And so I think that's our work. You know, it's like, what is Rachel's Buddha field? You know, what is your field of influence? And sometimes we should always work within that, but sometimes we can extend ourselves beyond, go into another Buddha field. Join some forces with somebody else's field. You know, in other words, and that's where we have to do what we can do and not expect that we are going to solve the problem, not have a kind of, you know, ego-centered, heroistic notion. But at the same time, because on the other hand, we can be so self-limiting. You know, I can't do anything. Who am I? You know, so to watch sort of tend to both sides, to both possibilities of that.
Thank you. You know, I'm thinking about, I used to be a student, professor teaching, but now I also have many friends who don't have the Buddhist practices available to them, and yet they are also in despair, they experience also all these difficulties, and I often didn't know what to share about my practice so that it is not proselytizing or they are not ready. So I'm wondering, what do you suggest? What are the essential things in our practice which we can share to people who are not Buddhists so that we give them some tools or help them along the way, which is even so difficult for us. Do you understand my question?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Yeah, I think your awareness of you know, how potentially is counterproductive if you try to proselytize. And I would say the first and foremost is your practice. When we practice, when we remember to practice being here, full presence with whoever we are with, moment after moment, they will feel it. You're not trying to like project anything. It's like you're just here and you are at ease with whatever's going on. You're not pretending to be at ease. You're actually at ease. And if you're upset, you're at ease with being upset. And other people can see, oh. And I remember many years ago, someone came to my retreat. And I opened a retreat asking, what brought you here? And this person said, I had this friend who's been practicing and he didn't hear anything, any Buddhism from this person. I can sense that he had his way of being. I want that. And I know this is a way to cultivate that. So many people are eager to like, let me tell you need to do this, you need to do that. I have another student who always like to like, it's like, I keep telling my husband he has to come to retreat, you know, like, he has to come to retreat, you know, you need to do what I'm doing. And I know her husband too, I said, you don't need to come to retreat. You know, she needs to come to retreat. And when you practice, you benefit people in your life. That for a lot of people, that's enough. And then when the way we practice, we're not causing them problems. Like, you need to practice, you know. Basically, you are telling them something's wrong with you. You need to go get fixed. That's a criticism. That's a little passive-aggressive, actually. Yeah. No, it's like, you don't need to. You practice, because somehow you only see imperfection in another person. And when you practice, people around you benefit from your practice. Whether they practice or not, at least they feel that they feel motivated to support your practice. Next time you want to come to a retreat, yes, I will take care of the kids. Don't worry, you go to retreat. Because your practice benefits them. And maybe when the causes and conditions ripen, they want, hey, you know, you want to show me how to meditate? You can show them how to meditate. Even my mom asked me to show her how to meditate. So, oh, okay, yeah, you can do this. That's it. I'm not, I don't like read this, you read all the 10 books by Master Shen Yan. Yeah, just do this one thing. And so skillful, and then watch our ego. Like, I do all these and these are all helpful. You should do all of them. That's appropriate for you and maybe not for this person. So it comes with the practice of paying close attention to how this person is now, not what you want them to be. And can we distinguish it? I hope that helps.
You know, I think that when Rebecca was talking earlier in her opening words about, you know, the news and how our attention is brought to all the difficulties, and our mind does have an inclination towards what is, you know, painful or difficult. Maybe that's survival, you know, because those are the things that would threaten it. You know, when we come into contact, and that can seem, you know, I can imagine somebody thinking that that's a very simplistic way of looking at things. Like, why should I be bringing my attention to beauty and joy in the world when there's all of this suffering? That's what really matters, which is a very dualistic way of looking at things, right? And so, but the urgency, you know, when we encounter suffering in someone and we feel that empathy, like, why do we feel that, right? I mean, isn't that interesting? That's such a deep human natural reaction. It's like there's something in us that knows that there is some kind of relation, there's something going on between me and this person. I don't even know them. I may never meet them. Why would I have that feeling? And I think that's what Joanna Macy is talking about. You know, this natural sense of compassion that arises because we have the same nature. That first moment of pain or of empathy, you know, that is so naturally arising is based, I think, in that unity of being. When we dwell in that, our attention shifts and is moving more and more away from the person and their suffering. And it's moving more and more towards ourselves, where we begin to be embroiled in our own thoughts, right, in our own emotions. And it can be very difficult as a practitioner to really actively try and release ourselves of those and or turn our attention to the good when somebody else is suffering. It doesn't seem right. You know, it doesn't seem fair that we can sit here this morning in this hall while all of these millions of people in Ukraine are dying and being bombed and fleeing their country. It doesn't seem right. And in a certain way, it's not right. It's not right that that is happening. It's not, in a very basic way, it's not fair, right? Karma is not a teaching of fairness. That's a very good sort of aspiration or model that we bring to our world, things should be fair. There should be equity, equality. Not that everybody believes in that. But that's an essentially religious and fairly universal concept, right? And so it seems wrong that we should actively work towards our own, you know, letting go of our own despair or grief while we attend to it honestly, while others are suffering. But to think about it and think, well, if I mire myself in this pain, who does that actually helping? Well, it's clearly not helping me. It's not, I mean, the person that I may be feeling grief about doesn't even know I'm feeling grief for them. I mean, think about all of the mental energy you applied towards our previous president. Whatever those thoughts might have been. He didn't know that. He didn't know you were having all those thoughts, right? And so if we think of it from the point of view of, as a practitioner, is this skillful? Is what I'm doing with my mind, the way I'm practicing my mind, is it skillful? Is it helping me? That can be a way of sort of making it a little less personal and making it much more powerful because we realize, no, it's not actually. this isn't actually helping anybody. It's actually keeping me from being more helpful. And then we can have more faith in actually letting that go or doing what we need to bring ourselves back to sort of full life without feeling like somehow I am ignoring or slighting or not honoring somebody else's suffering. I'm not, right? That's the dualistic view of things. It's either this or that. And the world is much better than that, right?
Now, I almost have the feeling that maybe I shouldn't ask the question because the microphone didn't work. I hope I get this out correctly because it's on my mind and it's quite complex. I've been struggling in conversations with friends when I have friends that are on a spiritual path. I have friends that are very much involved with activism. I have friends that do both, but also some that do one or the other. And what you just said, you know, that it's so, we have this capacity to feel for other people, and often it's when it's direct experience. But we live now in this really complex world where often our actions, like the results of our actions or the effects of our actions, are so removed that we don't often know what suffering we might be causing if we don't educate ourselves. And my activist friends always say, okay, yes, it's one thing to be good to the people around you, but if you're still sort of taking part in, you know, some of the things that are so entrenched in our culture, like where we buy our stuff or how we fly or how we travel through the world, you cause suffering down the line that you're not even aware of. And so do we have a responsibility to educate ourselves what all of our actions are actually doing, rather than just focusing on the immediate circle? Mm. And where's the balance? Because it's so complicated. Mm. Thank you.
I think so. And at the same time, you know, we will never know everything. So we'll always, you know, Wendell Berry said, given that we're always learning, and that we see that no matter what we've studied and how deeply we've studied it, we always have the capacity to learn more, right? We never reach an end. Another way of looking at that is that we're always functioning within a certain amount of ignorance. To know that brings forth humility. To not know that brings forth arrogance. And so to be humble, because we know that we're acting within a certain amount of ignorance, a certain amount of blindness. I don't understand everything about myself, about you, about any situation, and particularly, you know, as the world is so interwoven and interdependent and complex. And so that humility is a different way of being in the world, right? Whereas arrogance is very aggressive and tends to, you know, go first and try and, you know, just, it's sort of been our MO for so long, you know, just build something, launch it, and we'll deal with the consequences later, you know. And so to slow down and to really examine and question from what basis, what kind of world do we want to be creating? What is important in this world? What is important in our lives? Those are the questions that Buddhism asks us to ask ourselves, you know. I mean, aspiration, intention, vows, and commitments all are the result of a deep and thoughtful process of reflection, right? And there may not be enough of that going on in the world, right? Because it takes time. And we live in a very impatient, we have no patience for patience, right? It's very often seen as a weakness. That's why it's one of the paramitas. It's an incredibly powerful, dynamic, profound force, aspect of our being that we can easily dismiss. And so, you know, I think, you know, what Rebecca was saying, where if we as ourselves bring forth the Dharma within ourselves, if we do that as a Sangha, when Dogen said, when a person of a generous heart enters into an assembly, people notice. They might not know exactly what they're experiencing, but they experience something. I've also talked to many people over the years who came to the Dharma because of someone they knew, and they saw something. And these are not like big show-off practitioners. It's just people living their lives as practitioners. But we see something, right? And we wonder, what is that? Is there something going on that we want some to know more about? And I think that's one way that we can be of service. Maybe we should take one more and we'll finish up.
This is a question from Mikkel about faith. He's wondering, faith in what? And is it enough to be focusing on his own capacity for compassion, love, and joy, and work on not losing faith in that?
Yeah. Yeah. And the word faith, it's a bit loaded in our culture. Right? I talked about this morning the poem, Faith in Mind, the two characters. That's translated into faith here means trust. Trust, confidence. So, and how do we cultivate this trust, this confidence in the capacity of our mind, the capacity to give rise to compassion, to see clearly? By engaging in the practice, allowing that to arise. If we just sit here, it's like, I want to be compassionate. I want to be compassionate. It just remains an idea. And it's difficult to give rise to confidence and trust in our capacity by just sitting there wishing that I have compassion. Because it feels like that's something I don't have. Basically, you are reinforcing the idea that I don't have it, but I aspire to, I want to. It's the opposite of having trust, having faith in our capacity. When instead we engage in the practice, allowing ourselves to be fully here, and this gratitude arises naturally, this love, connection, compassion arising naturally. Ah, you experience it directly. It's not an abstract theoretical idea, not something you aspire to. More importantly, you stop thinking that it's something that you don't have, that you have to aspire to, you have to get. It's like, oh yeah, it's here. I see it. The moment we remember the practice, it's revealed. The moment we forget to practice, let all the vexations take over, agitation, hatred, it's obscured. So the faith we develop also is the faith in the practice. The faith in our ability to practice.
Yeah, and I think that being fully human means seeing all that the humanity that we possess. And so as we practice and sort of untie those knots of our own karma and those things that in which we create suffering, and we learn how to atone and to take responsibility, that we are learning how to have faith within ourselves. And that faith isn't based on, you know, eradicating all that, you know, the so-called negative and only being the positive, but actually holding the whole. And that trusting ourselves means sometimes realizing this mind right now is not actually trustworthy, right? If I follow this mind, I know what's going to happen. That's trusting myself. That's trusting yourself. And that the more that grows and deepens, because your mind is basically just mind, is the human mind, that it also helps us to very naturally have a stronger faith in each other. Because we realize the same thing's going on over there. They may be practicing, they may not. But the causes and conditions that we see as being so instrumental and that helps us to disidentify and make less personal, you know, our own personal tragedies and, you know, foibles and weaknesses and so on. And we realize it's just, you know, we have learned how to be in this body. We have learned how to be in this world in a particular way based in, you know, greed, anger, and delusion. And that as we clarify that and begin to free ourselves of that, we realize everybody has that capacity. Causes and conditions are happening in every person's life. That when somebody is acting in a particular way, that makes sense to them. It's logical, based in their worldview, based in their sense of self, which is a result not just of all of their own actions. You know, we didn't wake up and at some point in our lives decide, I am going to make myself into a self that has all of these different qualities, right? It's not like that. And we realize the same thing is happening in others, and that helps us to see them as human beings, sometimes as human beings who need to be stopped from what they're doing because they are creating harm for others and for themselves. So it doesn't mean compassion means being passive. Sometimes compassion is fierce, but that it is compassion. And I think that faith begins to just get larger and larger. And in the same way that sometimes I am not trustworthy, this mind, not I, my being, but just this mind, this attachment, this view, the same is true for others. We can have friends that we love dearly and realize there are certain ways in which they're not entirely trustworthy. If you have a friend who always shows up late, don't expect them to be on time, right? That's not a good expectation. And so that can actually, you can hold your faith in that person, understanding that that's an aspect not only of them, but of your relationship. My brother was like that. He was always late. And so at a certain point, my family said, you know what, we're just going to go ahead, right? And you can catch up. And so we didn't just stop trying to change him, and but we didn't exclude him either. But it was like, you take responsibility for your own actions, and we'll be happy to see you when you show up. But we're not going to wait. Did you want to say anything to close?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I would like to thank you for being here this weekend and being so generous with the Sangha and this morning. And we will keep your seat warm.
I'm taking this cushion home with me.
For the next time that you come back to visit us. I was telling Rebecca this morning at breakfast that I think it's so valuable to have a teacher from within our own tradition, but a different lineage that has a different history and a shared history, and to hear the teachings that are similar and different, to hear language that is similar and different. I always found that very faith-building, right? To hear the same teachings echoed from different teachers, different, even different lineages, different traditions, but the same basic, because it kept helping me to feel like, oh, this must be true. If all of these people from all these different lineages and times and cultures are basically saying the same thing, it must be true. And that helped me to have faith in it. So I really appreciate your coming and sharing yourself with us.
Thank you very much for having me and being so welcoming. Mm-hmm. I had a blast. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.